Thank you.
Case number 10-5048, Zaid Muhammad Salah Hakim, Kent Delta et al., versus Robert Gates, Secretary, U.S. Department of Defense et al., appellants. The criminal, the appellant, Mr. Walker, the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honor. Sharon Swingle for the government. I think there are a number of reversible errors that were committed by the district court in this case, and if I may just run through them. First, the district court required the government to show, in order to establish that Hatim was part of al-Qaeda or Taliban forces, that he received and executed orders from a military command structure. And I think this court's subsequent decisions, Bensaya, most recently last week's decision in Salahi, make clear that this is reversible error. The proper test for determining whether an individual is part of al-Qaeda is a functional one that looks to the conduct of the individual. And as this court explained in Bensaya, the real inquiry seeks to distinguish between the purely independent conduct of a freelancer and someone who is functionally part of the group. I think the evidence...
I mean, that's part of the part-of test. Does the freelancer issue have any purchase in the area of substantial support, what is called the substantial support prong?
Well, I think it can, Your Honor. Obviously, our principal argument here is that the evidence is appropriately viewed as establishing that Mr. Hatim is part of al-Qaeda or the Taliban. Of course, the district court didn't even reach the support issue because of its ruling that that was not legally founded.
It reached it but rejected.
Where does substantial support come from? Where does that, where does the government derive that idea?
Well, Your Honor, obviously, as we've set out in a number of cases and in Abahani especially, we do define substantial support as derived from the laws of war and informed by the laws of war, but as our construction of the AUMF. And I think as the court recognized in Bahani, certainly the government can choose to delimit its authority in that way.
I've seen the phrase substantial support, but I've also seen the phrase material support. What's the difference? Is there a difference?
Well, I don't think this court has had the occasion to reach that issue, and with respect, Your Honor, the government has not reached it for purposes of this case. I think if the court were not able to reverse on a part of determination, we would ask the court
Why does it have to be substantial? What is that support or aid? If we took an analogy to the criminal law, the common law offense of aiding and abetting does not require substantial aiding and abetting. It's just aiding and abetting. So where does the substantial thing come from?
Well, certainly, Your Honor.
Is that a higher, it's a more difficult standard to meet substantial than to convict somebody of aiding and abetting?
Without speaking to the relative weight as compared to the criminal law, certainly the government has chosen to define its scope of detention authority with reference to substantial support rather than simply support. And of course, this court's binding circuit precedent would also provide for detention in a case of material and purposeful support. But again, we are not taking a position on this case, how and whether that prong would come into play. I think it would really turn on presumably a decision by this court rejecting a part of theory and what evidence might be left after the court's decision. I think that would be a question for the district court on remand. I think for purposes of this case, our position really is that this evidence makes clear that this person is functionally part of al-Qaeda or the Taliban. He trained at the flagship al-Qaeda training camp. He spent a month there learning weapons training on rocket-propelled grenades, Kalishnikov.
I thought the district court discounted that evidence because it was derived from torture.
You are correct, Your Honor. The district court found in the alternative that he would discount that evidence entirely. In our view, that was simply not a permissible or reasonable construction of this evidence. I think if we look at the Supreme Court's guidance in the analogous Fourth Amendment context, we know that it is simply not the case that any coercive treatment, and certainly the government did not concede that Mr. Hatim had been mistreated during his time at Kandahar, which was his allegation, but certainly not any past coercive treatment will render all subsequent statements
unreliable. I don't know whether you can respond to this question, if you can't, in the open session, but what you just said triggers it. You said on page 17 of the public reply brief that the government, basically what you just said now, the government does not concede that Hatim was tortured at Kandahar, but then you added, and the government submitted evidence in the district court that undermined Hatim's claims of mistreatment. Did the government, the district judge said, Judge Urbina said in his opinion that the government did not present any evidence to refute the claim that he was mistreated. Now you say the opposite.
Well,
who's right?
Certainly the government believes its position is correct. If I could say two things, I think
is this something that you can get into in the closed session more easily than now? Or?
Yes, Your Honor, but I do think I can answer. I will say first, the government's position ultimately was to support the credibility of the statements that were made about Al-Farouk. And of course, we submitted documentary evidence, physical evidence of a training camp application prepared by Mr. Hatim, obviously fairly strongly corroborative evidence that in fact he then went to a training camp. We have his statement made at an earlier point, at least until the briefing in this case. It predated any of his allegations of mistreatment that, again,
but that doesn't go to, well, maybe it goes to it, maybe it's relevant to it, but the statement in your reply brief is that you put in evidence to show that he wasn't mistreated. He could have been mistreated and then given information that turns out to have been accurate information.
We
you're saying, evidence, well, the information he gave was accurate.
We put in evidence that related to his strong motivation to fabricate a story of mistreatment, Your
Did
Honor.
Did you introduce in this case the Al-Qaeda training manual?
Your Honor, if I can discuss that in closed session, please.
Okay.
But certainly, as this court recognized in Al-Adahi, obviously people in Mr. Hatim's situation do have a strong incentive at times to fabricate stories. And really making a credibility determination.
I didn't ask you what was in it. I asked you whether you introduced it. In Al-Adahi, the fact that the government introduced it wasn't considered classified or secret or anything.
Your Honor, consistent with the redactions in this case, if we could discuss in closed session.
All right.
And again, you know, we did not have a credibility finding here as to Mr. Hatim's own story, but I think it is striking just how lacking in credibility his own story was. He said, for example, in his own testimony before the C-cert, where he again repeated that he went to Al-Farouk, that he went there because it was like a summer camp. It was like a charity camp, and he went because his hobby was weapons, and he was a new person in the area. You know, the idea that an individual with no connections of any sort to Al-Qaeda would be allowed to attend the Al-Qaeda training camp as if it is a summer camp is simply not plausible. He then claimed that he went to the rear lines of hostilities under the command of a fighter, that he helped to supply Taliban soldiers there with food, that he checked out a weapon from the warehouse when he went to the front lines, and that during this period he was just an observer, that he was just visiting and wasn't integrated into that group. And I think those are just not plausible stories. And I think the district court's failure to make any credibility finding is, again, part and parcel of its unduly atomized treatment of the evidence in this case, that it took each piece of evidence showing his connections, whether it be his stays at multiple Al-Qaeda and Taliban guest houses, his training shooting at Al-Farouk, his receiving money during this time from an Al-Qaeda operative, his plans to escape from Afghanistan with the assistance of that Al-Qaeda operative and meet him in Pakistan so they could get out together. The court treated each piece of evidence without regard to the probative value that it had with respect to the other evidence, and in our view, that is reversible error.
Did he testify?
He did not, Your Honor. He did not. The evidence from him consisted of his sworn testimony before the CSIRT in 2005, where he again repeated his story that he had attended Al-Farouk, that he had then gone to the rear lines of hostilities, although, of course, he did attempt to downplay the significance of the role he played, and then his 2009 declaration supported.
So when he testified before the Combat Status Review Tribunal, he said that he had attended Al-Farouk?
He again testified that he had attended Al-Farouk.
And there's an opinion by Judge Hogan that in a case that has some parallel, I can't remember, the names kind of blend together after a while, but it has parallels to this case. And Judge Hogan and the detainee, again, alleged torture, and the statements that were made close in time or as a direct result, or during the time of the claim of torture, Judge Hogan excluded. But when it got to the testimony before the tribunal, Judge Hogan ruled that that dissipated the taint sufficiently so that those statements should be admitted.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What's the name of that case?
I don't have it at hand. We cite a case very much like that in the briefs. I'm not certain whether that's the Judge Hogan decision you've...
Right. I mean, so there's a conflict in that respect between the district judges about how to treat testimony before the tribunal.
Well, and if I can, Your Honor, I think the district courts have really followed the lead of the Supreme Court in the Fourth Amendment context by looking to factors like extrinsic corroboration, the length of time that has occurred, whether the interrogation is in a different place by different officials, whether the same testimony is repeated before an administrative tribunal like the CSIRT or the ARB. And here, all of those factors obviously weigh in favor of finding that his statements were credible. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Foster.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The question at bottom for this panel is whether to affirm this case or to remand it for further proceedings. This is one of the earlier district court decisions in these Guantanamo cases. It predates all of this court's opinions on merits appeals, and as this court just last week in the Salahi opinion, the court vacated and remanded a district court case because the district court had not had the benefit of some intervening decisions. So this court remanded to give the district court the opportunity in the first instance to reconsider its evidence in light of this court's further guidance. And as we just heard, the government's arguments here are generally similar in kind, that the district court's decision in this case is inconsistent with the later decisions of this court. So the question is whether to vacate and remand. And now we don't think that's necessary. We think this court should affirm the district court because the factual findings that the district court made resolve this case in Mr. Hatim's favor, both under the standards that it applied and under the standards that they have been subsequently announced by this court. Now the government addresses argues that the district court made three legal errors that require reversal and remand. Each one of them is wrong. The substantial support prong, it's true that the district court did exclude the substantial support prong from its detention standard. That is inconsistent with this court's decision in Bahani. But that error was harmless because there's nothing in the government's case on which it continues to rely in this appeal to permit a finding that Hatim was a substantial supporter under the Bahani standard. Bahani is very clear that the support prong extends to those who purposefully and materially support Al-Qaeda or Taliban forces in hostilities against the United States or coalition partners. Now, those hostilities didn't begin until October 7th, 2001. The district court rejected, and the government on appeal does not rely on, any evidence that Hatim did anything after October 7 or even after 9/11 that had anything to do with hostilities against the United States or coalition partners, whether part of such forces or substantially supporting them. And, you know, the government never said in its brief, and I think I just heard Ms. Wingle say today, that they don't have a theory under the case.
I have a question in the same admonition, if you can't answer it except in closed session, but because it all kind of runs together now that I've read the redacted and the unredacted part. But the question is, why did this gentleman go from Yemen to Afghanistan? What was his explanation for that, for traveling to Afghanistan?
As I recall, he gave a couple of explanations. He felt he was too much of a burden on his family, couldn't afford his university studies anymore.
He was studying to be a lawyer? Is that what
that's correct. He was studying Islamic law in Yemen. He had plans to marry a woman, but as I recall, either her family or his didn't approve. He was depressed over that. He had heard of the conflict in Chechnya between Muslims in Chechnya and Russia.
That's the part that I wanted to explore.
Yes.
He heard of the conflict and wanted to participate in it, right? Fight the Russians?
Well, you know, he says in his declaration that it was an idea he was considering. He hadn't made that definite determination, but he did want a change of pace. He did want to reduce the burden on his family.
My question. Let's suppose that he said clearly, I'm going to Afghanistan. One of the reasons, or the reason, was that I want to fight the Russians in Chechnya. And he goes to, I mean, he's not going to be, I mean, I don't know that you just go to Russia and but you join an organization, I would suppose. You find weapons. You get. He was already trained. Wasn't he in the Yemen military for a while?
He had a year of compulsory service in the Yemeni military.
If that's all there was, it was no intention to fight the United States. It was only to fight the Russians. Is it your position that he cannot be held?
I think it's certainly our position that he could not be held purely on that basis.
What I'm getting at is kind of like the Uyghurs. Who had no intention, at least according to the evidence we saw, to attack the United States. It was to attack China, right?
Right. I think it is an analogous situation. I mean, yes.
I just didn't see that being brought out in any of the public briefs. That line, which struck me as analogous to the Uyghur case.
I think that is an apt analogy that. The intentions had nothing to do with the United States. I think we did argue that in the district court.
You did argue that?
I believe we did.
I mean, because all the training, even if you conceded he went to Al-Farouk, the Uyghurs were training in Tora Bora. But that didn't get them to the proposition that they were, enemies in the or enemy combatants.
All right, that is true.
All right.
Yes. In any event,
let's go back to a proposition you asserted, which I think was that his activities, manifesting, being part of, or support, would have to have occurred after 9/11. But I'm just wondering whether that is really the case. Let's say there was evidence that he was part of forces that, in fact, as it proved later, were conducting warfare against the United States in October of 2001. But there's no evidence specifically attaching him to those forces after 9/11. Does it follow that he's not covered by the AUMF? In other words, I understand that if you have him completely out being an accountant in New York at the time, clearly can't be held responsible for what those forces were, or charged in any way with what those forces were up to in October. But what if there's just a blank?
Well, I think I can answer that question more directly on the facts of this case in the closed session.
Sure.
But All right. We'll just save it for them.
Well, actually, I mean, my question is really devoted to the legal standard.
Right.
If you want to save it for the closed session, sure. That's fine.
All right. With regard to the command structure test, again, this case came out before Awad and Bin Saya and the other ones that made clear that command structure or receiving executing orders is sufficient but not necessary. And it's true that the district court's opinion in this case, as in the others that predated this court's decisions, discuss command structure and orders. But the district court did not rest on those findings alone. It also made findings related to the functional test that this court has subsequently enunciated for whether one is part of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, and concluded that there was no basis to find that he was functionally part of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. for example, with respect to the evidence of Al-Farouq, again, as has already been discussed, the district court did not find reliable or credible the evidence that he attended Al-Farouq, but alternatively held that even if he had attended, and even if by so doing he had received and executed orders, it found no basis for the determination on the entire record that he remained a member of Al-Qaeda at the time of his capture. There's this issue of whether he served in an area the government refers to as Saeed Central Station. The district court found no evidence that Hatim admitted to doing any fighting there, as the government had claimed, and, quoting the opinion, little indication that he served on behalf of Al-Qaeda during his stay at Saeed Central Station or any other time. With regard to the guest house allegations, the district court found the record utterly devoid of evidence that Hatim was aware of any affiliation his guest houses may have had with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, and no evidence that he'd acted on behalf of an enemy armed force during his stays, whether they were under orders or not. The government also says that the district court failed to evaluate the evidence collectively as a whole. He looked at each piece in isolation. But in addition to the examples I just gave where he viewed the evidence as a whole during the body of his analysis, he came right out and said at least twice at the end of his opinion that the district court considered all the evidence as a whole, and that the court, viewing the evidence as a whole, held that the government failed to prove its case by a preponderance. There's absolutely no basis to accuse the district court of not doing exactly what it said he did.
It seems to me that the passage where he says, if the individual piece he's quoting, Al-Adahi in the district court, if the individual pieces of a mosaic are inherently flawed, then the mosaic will split apart. Fine metaphor, but I guess it partly depends upon what we mean by individual pieces. Let's say if the item of evidence is in every respect totally worthless, then the metaphor hangs together. Clearly, no problem. But first place, to the extent that one tile may support the validity of another tile, it doesn't exactly address that issue. And we just don't know what inherently flawed means. It might mean is totally incredible and I reject it altogether, or something far short of that.
Right. Well, I think, first of all, when quoting the Al-Adahi District Court opinion there, I think that's the fairly unremarkable evidentiary proposition that is sort of the corollary to a brick is not a wall.
Yeah,
a bad brick is not...
The exact meaning is very...
it's a little unfortunate that the tile mosaic analogy has come up because it conflates with the intelligence community's mosaic theory. but I think it's clear when the district court says that there's little indication that he served on Al-Qaeda during his time at Saeed Central Station or any other time, and there's no basis for a determination that he remained Al-Qaeda, a part of Al-Qaeda at the time of his capture, even if he had attended Al-Farouq. I think that makes clear that what the district court has done is said that with respect to each tile, the evidence wasn't there, wasn't sufficient to prove the tile. So the tiles don't come together then to fill out the picture.
I may be remembering this incorrectly, but did the district court also say that because he left Al-Farouq, it follows that he severed his ties with Al-Qaeda?
Well, he doesn't just say that.
The district court did say something like that.
He did say something like that. He said that
I don't understand that. I mean, because it's a training camp, and anybody that trains there leaves after they're trained. So
Right.
That doesn't sever your connection with that.
That's right. But the evidence in this case was that Mr. Hatim didn't like the camp almost from the first day. He wanted to leave early. He did leave early. He never came back. And there's no further evidence in the record that enabled the district court to find that he remained a part of Al-Qaeda after having left early. He was a washout.
Some of these cases introduced evidence that if you left the training camp early, you'd get beaten severely. Was there evidence to that effect here?
That he was beaten severely, or evidence that when one leaves the camp early?
Yeah, when one leaves the camp early.
I don't recall there being any specific evidence about what happens in general when one leaves the camp early. The evidence in this case showed either that he faked an illness to leave or that he, in fact, was sick and was able to get out early as a result. I see I've far exceeded my time. May I conclude? As stated thus far, we don't think remand is appropriate here. The district court brought its expertise and experience as a fact finder to bear, weighed the evidence appropriately as a whole, and made plausible, permissible, well-supported factual findings that resolved this case in Hatim's favor, even under this court's subsequent decisions. So we ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. Ms. Swingle, are you out of time? All right, unless you want to say something in the public session, we'll go into the closed session. All right, okay, go ahead.